On January 15th, AD 69, the Praetorian Guard made Otho, legate of the now deceased Galba, the third emperor in less than just a year. Only a month or two before the assassination, coins were minted with the slogan Concordia Provinciarium, or Harmony in the Provinces. In reality, that was a lie. The military autocracy established by Augustus was in fact developing serious fractures. Nero and then his successor Galba had been assassinated in Rome, and the new emperor, Otho, was hardly established. And with so much uncertainty in the capital city, and then ongoing conflicts and rebellions in places like Britannia, Germany, and Judea, there were plenty of opportunities for ambitious generals and governors to earn victories that gave their soldiers the excuse to proclaim them as emperors. And as we'll see in this episode, that is exactly what happened. Episode 23, the year of the four emperors, Otho and Vitellius. Before we begin, just a short announcement. I'm pleased to say that I will be giving a talk sponsored by the Smithsonian Associates. This is the educational arm of the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. of the United States. They will be hosting me to give a talk on January 30th of 2024, 6:45 p.m. Just type in my name and Smithsonian Associates or Smithsonian into Google, and you can find that event. It is a ticketed event, so there is a cost. It will be offered via Zoom, so it doesn't matter where you're at in the world. I'll be talking about my research on the Antonine Plague. I'm sure I will also take questions as well. All right, with that announcement all sorted, let's get to today's episode. What little we know of Otho's short reign suggests that he sought to arrest what was looking to become a prolonged civil war. Rome had been rocked by waves of murderous rampages. First, Nero and many of his followers were killed, and then about 8 months later, as we learned last time, Galba and several of his followers were murdered. And although Otho had permitted the execution of Galba's main cadre, including his successor, really, he was quite merciful and called for a general amnesty. And many of Galba's supporters that survived were invited into positions in the new regime. So too, by the way, were many of Nero's supporters who had fled Rome with little more than their lives. So many of Nero's supporters also found their way back to the capital. With this amnesty, Otho wasn't just trying to reestablish peace. He desperately needed competent and experienced administrators, and he also needed military commanders, especially in the Western Empire, because it was there that Galba had replaced many of Nero's appointees. Otho no doubt hoped that by giving Nero's men high offices in the Western provinces, that this would cause them to be loyal to him and to fight for him. After all, there was that general Vitellius. He had been the governor of one of the German provinces, and he was calling himself emperor. And people that mattered in the West were giving some thought to supporting Vitellius. Several Western legions and several Western governors. It seemed like it would just be a matter of time before Vitellius accumulated enough military might to actually march on Rome and to take the capital from the newly crowned Otho. I mean, it was one thing to be named emperor in the provinces, as Vitellius was, but at this point in time, possession of Rome still mattered. It conferred a degree of legitimacy. And so in that moment, Rome was in Otho's possession. And Vitellius, despite his growing power and influence in the Western provinces, was still, for that reason, on the outside looking in. He needed to take Rome. But what about in the Eastern Empire? Many of Nero's appointees were still in power there. Galba had not been able to replace or exile or assassinate many of those administrators. And so Otho, by declaring a general amnesty, likely shored up the support of some of those administrators. Now, funnily enough, we have some coins of Otho from the eastern provinces, and they don't show Otho's face. Despite the fact that these coins bear Otho's name, they show Nero's portrait. Now, was this simply because there had not been enough time for Galba or now Otho's image to arrive all the way to the mentors in places like Syria and Egypt? Nope, that's not what happened. We'd have Galba's Eastern coins, and they show his grim and grumpy face on those coins. So Otho's coins were purposefully minted with Nero's face. And this was likely because the people who received the money from Nero, including many of Nero's legions, were still, despite the Senate's hatred of Nero, quite favorably disposed to the prodigal ex-emperor. Otho wanted to capitalize on Nero's popularity. He even contemplated at one point taking Nero's name as his own. Basically, Otho wanted everybody to know that Nero was back in style again under his regime. But Otho needed more than just a recycled marketing campaign, which was basically, hey, remember Nero? Didn't you like Nero? Well, I'm one of his guys. I support him. Remember Nero? I mean, you can't imagine that this kind of propaganda would be all that successful unless there was some actual substance behind it. Just to give a totally implausible analogy, it would be as if some new film studio attempted to create a bunch of fresh Star Wars films with lightsabers and the Force and all the trappings of the old films, but with new characters that were one-dimensional shadows of the old characters, and with incoherent plots that made little sense in light of the lore and legacy of the old Star Wars films. Again, that's a ludicrous example. I'm sure something like that would never happen. But for Otho, the marketing campaign was important because of what Vitellius was doing. By February of AD 69, he had crossed with his legions into Italy. This was the moment that Otho had dreaded. The civil wars were going to continue. His new western governors and his legions in northern Italy offered some resistance against the march of Vitellius. And in the meantime, Otho also held the loyalty of several legions near the Danube River in the Balkans. Now, they were marching rapidly towards Italy to catch Vitellius's soldiers in what we might think of as a hammer and an anvil. All Otho had to do was wait for the hammer to arrive. But for whatever reason, he decided not to wait. He went for it. And so he clashed with Vitellius's soldiers in northern Italy, expecting a sweeping victory. And we don't know the size of his army, but it was probably around 40 or maybe 50,000 soldiers. It could have been a little larger, maybe a little smaller. And had he waited for the rest of his soldiers from the Danube, he probably would have had a much larger army. That would have been important because Vitellius had something like 70,000 legionaries. And so when the two armies clashed finally in April of AD 69, Otho's soldiers were soundly defeated. They were just simply outnumbered. We have one source that tells us that 40,000 Roman soldiers lost their lives in that battle alone. Otho's surviving soldiers, in order to preserve their lives, took an oath of allegiance to their new emperor, now Vitellius. And for Otho, he chose a fate that was different than that of his soldiers. And we have his final words. Now, these are either recorded and are somewhat accurate or are maybe guessed at by the senator Cassius Dio. He's the one that recorded them. But whether they're real or whether they're just an approximation of what Otho said, here is part of the speech. Quote, "I hate civil war, even though I conquer, and I love all Romans, even though they do not side with me. Let Vitellius be victor, since this has pleased the gods. Surely it is far better and far more just that one should perish for all than many for one." And as I said, that's recorded by Cassius Dio. So those are the words of Otho, and he was true to those words. He decided that one man should perish so that many men would not die in a continuing civil war. The defeated emperor, like Nero, took his own life. He had reigned only 91 days, and this is the shortest reign of any emperor yet to take the purple that we have studied on this podcast. But unlike Nero, Otho's suicide was ostensibly to preserve the empire from more civil war. That's what that speech was getting at. It's worth asking, was he really this noble? Well, maybe he was. The great Roman poet Martial actually wrote a few lines not more than two decades after Otho killed himself. And Martial praises Otho for his suicide, which he does say preserved the lives of many Roman soldiers. So perhaps Otho really was as noble as his reputation suggests. But unfortunately, Otho's sacrifice only prevented more bloodshed for a few weeks or a few months at most. The way to Rome was now open, and Vitellius's soldiers marched to the city. And by the way, we're told that they looted numerous Italian towns and settlements on their way there, threatening the citizens with violence. It was a civil war, after all, and Italy had sided with Otho. When he finally arrived in Rome, Vitellius was sworn in as emperor, but he waited a little while to take the titles of Caesar and Augustus until they were offered by the Senate. But this was about the only thing that seems restrained about Vitellius, at least as the sources describe him. Now, they are almost certainly biased because Vitellius would be cast as an enemy by the regime that replaced him, but we'll talk more about that regime in a future podcast episode. In the meantime, we're told that Vitellius had many of the supporters of previous regimes murdered. Obviously, that includes Otho's loyalists in the elite, but others too were swept up in the murders. But it wasn't just elites that were killed. Vitellius purged several of Otho's legions of their officers. In other words, he murdered centurions who had otherwise done nothing wrong. And Vitellius also wanted to trade on the popularity of Nero's memory. So he offered lavish feasts, spent money like crazy, offered entertainments for the crowds. At one point, he supposedly brought out old Sporus. And I don't know if you remember that name. He was Nero's eunuch, who the emperor thought looked like Poppaea Sabina, his former wife. So Vitellius even brought Sporus out to perform for the population. Now, so much of what we have talked about in this episode and the previous one on the Year of the Four Emperors has been going on in the western half of the Roman Empire, especially in parts of Germany and Gaul and Italy. But what of the East? We haven't said much about what was going on in the East. Well, if you remember, back under Nero, Judea revolted against Roman rule, and that province was still in rebellion. And the general that had been appointed by Nero to solve that problem, you might remember his name was Vespasian. Well, he was winning some success in the province of Judea and was finding himself with increasing support among both the legions in the eastern half of the empire, as well as several of the governors. And sources often like to suggest, by the way, that Roman soldiers just get so caught up in the victories of their generals that this caused them to spontaneously offer the title of empire to otherwise unwilling and unwitting commanders. But in fact, when these sorts of things happen, when provincial governors or generals are given the title of imperator, it's normally planned well in advance. And so it's unlikely that Vespasian was surprised when, in summer of AD 69, the governor of Egypt administered the loyalty oath for his soldiers, for soldiers in his province, but not in the name of the reigning emperor Vitellius, but instead in the name of Vespasian. And then the Judean and the Syrian legions followed and swore allegiance to Vespasian as well. Now, back in Rome, Vitellius would have heard about this fairly quickly. We don't know how much he worried, but he did have some advantages. One of these was the fact that he pulled a bunch of soldiers from the western provinces into Italy to act as a defense against someone marching on Rome. Finally, somebody figures out that people march on Rome and perhaps the city should be defended. But of course, this removes resources from provinces that were not fully secured. And so parts of Germany especially revolt against Roman rule, which causes Vitellius both practical but also some symbolic problems. But then a surprise betrayal made Vitellius's position even weaker. You might remember that Otho had those Danubian legions. They were supposed to be the hammer when Otho was fighting Vitellius. They just couldn't get there fast enough, and Otho had been impetuous and fought without them anyway. Well, those legions had been forced to swear a loyalty oath to Vitellius after Otho lost the civil war. But now that Vespasian had declared himself emperor, these legions, even though their oath had just been sworn a few weeks ago, decide to renege on that oath and take a new oath to Vespasian. Now, a major influence on this was probably the fact that Vespasian's brother was nearby. He took command of these legions and they marched towards Rome. And despite the fact that Vitellius had about 20,000 soldiers near Rome, they simply could not compete with all of the legions that were gradually making their way to the city. Vitellius knew that he was in a pretty desperate situation, and that desperation is probably what saved the life of Vespasian's youngest son. He was about 17 years old and in Rome under the watchful eye of Vitellius. Vitellius could have killed Domitian at any time, but he chose not to. Instead, he went out to fight the first wave of legions that was making their way towards Rome, and Vitellius was soundly defeated. Now, as a mercy, Vespasian's brother offered Vitellius clemency if he was willing to abdicate, and Vitellius took the offer, and it would seem at this point now that the civil wars were finally over. After over a year of fighting, battles that were especially devastating in the northern regions of Italy finally seemed to be over. Everyone probably took a deep breath, and arrangements were made for the new regime to take over from the old. It was a moment of calm, and in this moment of calm, Vitellius re-entered the palace at the head of a band of militia. Vespasian's brother was taken captive and killed. Vespasian's son, Domitian, was probably on the kill list as well. He managed to escape the palace and disguise himself as a priest and therefore stay alive. Now, the chaos in the city in this moment just burst afresh and was overwhelming. It was violent. It was fiery. The streets were filled with fighting. We know that many buildings were destroyed, including the great and very old temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus, the great chief deity of the city of Rome. But as you might guess, Vitellius's supporters fought a losing battle. And in the end, the next wave of Vespasian's legions reached Rome, and they executed a swift and bloody takeover. Vitellius was killed, and for the first time in 18 months, one man ruled Rome without any living opposition. And this man, Vespasian, had become a power in Judea by violently suppressing the Jewish people. His son Titus, by the way, who would later succeed Vespasian as emperor, was actually still in Judea. And as we'll learn next time, Titus would commit an act of cultural violence that would forever change the history of one of the world's greatest religions. The Pax Romana's worst civil war was indeed over, but peace was only secure for a precious few. in provinces such as Judea, Roman dominion came at a tremendous cost. In this case, the destruction of the Jewish temple. We'll talk about it next time on the Pax Romana podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Pax Romana podcast. For more information, including a list of primary sources and further reading, check the show notes. Music by Red Productions and Exocor. Follow Dr. Colin Elliott on X at ProfCPE or email colin@paxromanapodcast.com. Listen to more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or just about anywhere podcasts are available. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Pax Romana podcast.